We're going to be attempting to look at four different types of abuse. That's physical abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, and spiritual abuse. But before we get into the specific types of abuse, Daryl asked the question, why is it necessary to look at these? Some of the things we'll be talking about, some of the things we'll be looking at, you may think it's over the top. It's extreme. It happens out there. This would not be happening in the church. It is true that things happen out there in the, quote, world. And I agree it should not be happening in the church, but that's mostly who I work with, is people from church. And so I'm going to say that it is. Later on, I'm going to be reading some section out of the book here. It's not a very pleasant book. It's by Jimmy Hinton. It's called The Devil Inside. One of the quotes he makes in that book is this: the church's record on abuse should embarrass us. When secular researchers rightly name the church as the most dangerous place for children, it ought to spark a fight inside every one of us. Not a fight to cover it up, but a fight to protect the little ones. And not only the little ones, but all of us. An RCMP officer, a Christian lady from, I think she was from British Columbia, said this, that the church is prime grounds for predators to find their prey. And that's sad. Some of the stuff that we'll be looking at today is, I find, very difficult. I'm not here to trash the church or the Amish and Mennonite culture, nor to say that they haven't done any good, because they have. I appreciate my culture. I appreciate my upbringing. But I also have to say that there are some terrible things that have gone on in the church. It's not just out there, it is among our people. I find myself in a very, very tough spot today. There's a group of broken and destroyed people that are counting on me to speak and be a voice for them. But there's also a group of people that are very offended if we speak the truth. And I'm stuck in the middle. In some ways, it feels like I'm the only voice that some have, and I want to do that for them. But on the other hand, I feel like there's a gun to my head or a knife to my throat if I do. So pray for me. I realize we'd all like to believe these things don't happen. We'd all like to believe that the stuff we'll be looking at isn't true. And I've been told to my face that this stuff is not true. I don't believe it. And I know this does not happen. I've been called negative, a Mennonite hater, I'm making things up, or things like, it's just worst case scenarios, that's just what you see. But are we okay with those worst case scenarios among us? I hope not. There's been individuals that have been knocked unconscious, wife spanking, children have been beat so they can't sit, threatening young children with hell, that is, adults, they still have panic attacks, adults meeting young children for sex, And the list goes on. In fact, in the last few months, there's a conservative Mennonite minister that was just arrested for child trafficking and meeting a child for sex. The issues I mentioned there are things that I have met up with. One thing I'd like to say to those of you that are here, if you have experienced abuse, you may find some of this material triggering. We're going to be wading through some heavy stuff. And if you do, if you need someone to talk to, someone to pray with, just someone to cry with, we will try to have people available for that. So we'll start with looking at, like I mentioned, we'll be looking at the four different kinds of abuse. We'll start with physical abuse. Proverbs 10, verse 11, in the Amplified Version says this, "The mouth of the uncompromisingly righteous man is a well of life, but the mouth of the wicked conceals violence." What is physical abuse? And I'm going to be looking at a number of them. Beat up or beating up, beating on an individual with belts, belt buckles, sticks, hoses, clubs, wires, beat the devil out of a child. This is not talking about spanking. And we'll talk about that in a bit. But this is beatings. Remember working with an individual that was beat with a belt buckle because they didn't sit still in family devotions. I mean beat. I don't have this in my notes, but I'm almost at the point where I'm wishing Mennonites and Amish people wouldn't have family devotions. Family devotions done properly is good. Please hear me correctly. But I have worked with too many people that have been destroyed in family devotions, where they can't pray, they can't read their Bible, they can't, there's just lots of things that go on. They panic. Now, if you have family devotions and you have good family devotions, by all means, keep having family devotions, that's okay. But there are some cases where I wish they wouldn't. Next one is hitting, whether that's hit on the head, slapped across the face, hitting where a person is knocked unconscious, and that list goes on. Spanking that is overdone is abusive. It is not spanking. According to the laws of Ontario, from my understanding, spanking is legal between the ages of 2 and 12. However, if you're out in public and someone sees you spanking a child and they see it as abusive, they are actually obligated by the law of Canada to report it. But I'm going to say that if you spank your child in public, that also falls under the emotional abuse category. That shouldn't happen in public. There are proper ways of spanking that work, and I don't have time to go into that today, but this abusive spanking may make a child comply, but it doesn't work. It locks everything up. Next one is kicking someone. This is simply what it is saying. It's kicking. Or kicking people around. Next one is shaking someone. Shaking a small child or anyone for that matter. This often happens with small children. And in some cases, it happens with special needs children. I've just recently been told of a situation where someone shook a child, and it was a special needs child, but the child was shook, and then they would have better behavior for at least a few hours. Throwing someone bigger than throwing an individual, or throwing them in a car seat, or throwing them in a car. If it's a thing where it's done in a playful thing, sometimes parents will kind of throw their child on the bed or something like that, and it's a playful thing and it's enjoyable by all. I don't have a problem with that. But the other I do have a problem with. Poisoning someone, whether that's putting some poison in a person's food or drink, using ether to sedate someone, or involuntary drugs that affect a person's mind to sedate or tranquilize. Next one is burning someone, whether that's holding someone over the fire or making someone something hot and branding a person to gain control, or they will get told this is how hell will feel. Next one is scalding someone, putting someone in too hot a liquid or pouring too hot a liquid on someone. Whoops, sorry about that. Next one is drowning someone or attempted drowning, purposely trying drowning someone or attempts to do so. Next one is suffocating someone, shutting off a person's oxygen and air so they cannot breathe, whether that's grabbing around the throat or whatever they do to shut off the oxygen. To pushing someone, I understand what it's like to be in a circle, pushed from one side to another, losing all sense of direction and too dizzy to stand, falling in a heap on the ground, or whether it's pushing someone out around or forcing someone into something by pushing them. Next one is dragging, being dragged around or yanking on the ears. My opinion is the ears were given to you on the side of your head. These little flaps here were designed to catch sound waves so you can hear. I don't think they were made to be pulled on. Pulling hair, whether that's out of anger or control to force compliance. Next one is excessive tickling. And this, I could give you examples on each of these of people that I've met up with, but I don't have time to do that. Excessive tickling. And this is when a child, sometimes children ask, can you tickle me, can you tickle me? I find it really hard to do that when my children ask that, and that part of the reason is it's because of what I've met up with. But the moment they say stop, I stop immediately. And I think it's important to know that. There's been situations where children have been taken into headlocks, or they've taken the head between the knees and they just tickle them and tickle them and don't stop. And sometimes, right, in the group of adults, I had one situation where it happened right there's a whole bunch of aunts and uncles sitting around, and they thought this was funny, and this child was being tickled and tickled and tickled and tickled and tickled. And they wouldn't quit. And then the child wet himself. And they thought that was funny. To this day, if that child laughs too hard, too much, it still happens. And he's older than I am. I actually know of two people where that still happens. The one individual, they were on vacation with friends, and they were walking down the sidewalk. And somebody said something that was really funny. And they started laughing and laughing and laughing. And all of a sudden, the lady was gone. and she had taken off into an alley between two buildings because she couldn't hold it. It was because of extreme tickling as a child, as a very young child. So if your children ask to be tickled, I'm okay with you tickling them, providing you stop the first time they say no, stop, or they imply in any other way, if they can't say stop, that you stop if it's too much. Be very sensitive to that. Next one is domestic violence, any type of violence or abuse in the home, or anything else that causes physical harm. The next one is emotional abuse. James chapter 3, verse 9 says this, "Therewith bless we God, even the Father, and therewith curse we men, which are made after the similitude of God. Out of the same mouth proceedeth blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not so to be." In other words, it's not right. Cursing is not something that gets talked about very much. But another way of saying emotional abuse is cursing someone. There's a lot of times there are actually curses connected to the emotional abuse, and as you'll see as we go through this, you'll notice some of that. Definition of emotional abuse is any type of abuse that involves a continual emotional mistreatment of any individual or child, youth or adult. It's sometimes called psychological abuse. Emotional abuse can involve deliberately trying to scare, humiliate, isolate, ignore, or an individual, child, youth, or adult. The first one on the list is mocking and made fun of. Anything, that can be anything from a person's physical features, how they dress, how they do things, their family lineage, or in any way that they don't measure up to the elite or measure up to the Joneses or whatever group you want to call them. Then sometimes they're laughed at, made fun of, looked down on. Even if there's a mistake made or someone doesn't quite do it the same way others do it, to laugh and to mock is very destructive. The next one on the list is lovey-dovey. I wasn't sure what else to call it. But this is basically giving someone everything they want and all the lovey-dovey in order to cover up other abuses. In fact, the book that I've talked about here is, there's a little quote on the front cover. It says, "How my minister father molested kids in our home and church for decades and how I finally stopped him." And this guy had no idea that his father was actually doing this. He thought he had a most wonderful dad. Until the day his sister came and told him differently. And by that time, Jimmy was already pastoring as well. So sometimes this lovey-dovey stuff is done to get people to do what you want. It leaves the victim and others confused. And when they're confused, they're not able to figure out what's actually going on. Because the perpetrator was so kind, but extremely deceptive. One person worded it this way, it felt slimy. You can't get a hold of it. It just slides and slithers and gooshes and gets away and out of your grasp. The next one is gaslighting. Or the experience of being manipulated into doubting your feelings and perception of reality. Examples of gaslighting. If someone insists that you said or did things you know you did not. They deny or scoff at your recollection of events. They call you too sensitive or crazy when you express your needs or concerns. They express doubts to others about your feelings, behavior, and state of mind, twisting and retelling events to shift blame to you. Next one is isolating you from loved ones. Not allowed to be with family or friends, always kept under the control of another. A spouse not allowed to get groceries. A spouse not allowed to have money. A spouse not measuring up. Or even to the point of a spouse measuring out how much soap is allowed to be used. I'll be a little further on. I'm going to be looking into a little bit more on what are unsafe relationships. Next one is using insulting language and words that bruise, whether they're put-down statements, degrading statements like you're stupid, you will never learn, you will never amount to anything, look at your brother or your sister or your friend, why can't you be like them? And that list just goes on and on. So any type of degrading or put-down statements like that. Yelling, aggressive verbal outbursts of blame, degradation, anger, and such like. Next one is shifting the blame. Comes into gaslighting, we looked at. Not taking responsibility for their actions, but putting the blame on everybody else. Outbursts of unpredictable anger. Unresolved anger issues, which is bitterness, is the root of angry outbursts. But those do a lot of damage. Degrading and name-calling, which is similar to the insulting language, where people are told they're the scum, they're fat, they're ugly duck. If you weren't so fat, then life would be easier. Some of you are going to understand this word, some of you may not. A Dumpfkopf is another one. A retard, or you're retarded. In fact, I had a few people that in my office that were actually convinced they're retarded. And they would ask me, like, you don't think I am? I'm like, no, I don't think so. There's no reason to think that you are. Well, I'm pretty sure I am. Well, no, I don't. I have no reason to believe that. But they were convinced they were. Another one, emotional abuse, is an adult depending on a child for emotional support. When adults look to children for emotional support, and this next statement is one we hear a lot, or I've heard a lot, and I never really gave it much thought until the one day when I realized what it's actually saying, and that is the phrase, I need a hug from you. Adults often say that to children. There was a young lady at the age of 4, walked into the kitchen one day, and her mother, which had a depression issue, says, I need a hug from you. And she said, from that day forward, I knew that our roles switched. It was now my responsibility to be there for mom. So I quit using that phrase with my children. Instead of saying, I need a hug from you, I like to use the phrase, I have a hug for you. Makes a world of a difference. Because now you're giving something, you're not needing something from them. And then the bottom one is, or any other emotional mistreatment, there could be lots more than what I have on the list. I'm going to talk a little bit about unsafe relationships. And this, a lot of this information comes from Patrick Doyle. If you are interested at all, you can actually go on YouTube and look up Unsafe Relationships by Patrick Doyle, and you will actually get a lot of this information. In this next section, when I use the word offended, and this is the Patrick Doyle information, when I use the word offended, that means the victim, and the offender is the perpetrator. Unsafe relationships do not stay the same. They will always progress worse. The offended will often rationalize with a phrase like, oh, that was nice. But what rationalizing actually does at that point, it gives the offender grounds to keep going. The offender thrives then on taking more and more ground until the offended is trapped, and then the offender has free rein. If the offended would dare to say anything at that point, it might come out with great intensity because it's been bottled up and bottled up for so long, and all of a sudden it just comes. The offender will then quite likely respond with, well, look at you. Look what you've just done now. That wasn't a very Christian attitude. And at that moment, the offended very often backs right off because they feel like they are at fault and have no grounds to speak anymore. And that often happens. The offender now has tremendous power on the offended and takes ownership of them. The offended are often afraid then to make a scene, especially in church or around friends. Forgiveness is very important. It's your duty. And I'm going to say at that point, it's not a matter of forgiveness. We're dealing with a much greater issue than just forgiveness. And we'll be looking, in the last topic, we'll be looking at forgiveness a little bit, very briefly, because it is an important aspect, but that's not where we start. And there's often some very wrong and misconceptions of forgiveness. That's a topic all on its own. Or the offended will feel like they don't want to cause a problem, or the fear of this will make me look even worse. The number one rule of an unsafe person is they do not take responsibility. Instead of taking responsibility, they rationalize, they minimize, they justify, they spiritualize, or they deny. There's no sign of brokenness or repentance. They cannot look a person in the eye and say, I was wrong, what I did to you. Instead, they will still try to control the offended. The offended are very often made to feel that they have to make everything okay. It's their responsibility to keep things from going wrong. And the offended feel like this is the reason that they are the reason that this is happening. The offended does not have to motivate the offender to change. The offender is very smooth, talks very smoothly without taking any responsibility. The offender is often looked up to in the community. They're liked by others. They're charming. They have a good reputation. They're kind to others. And the offended will often doubt their own instincts. And why? When they're alone with the offended, the offender is a very different person. When this happens, the offender takes full charge of the person. When the offender is harming them and turning it around and blaming the offended, and when that happens, the offender takes full charge of the person, and it continues to escalate. Another sign of an unsafe relationship is confusion. Or like the offended is losing their mind or going crazy. Confused most of the time when talking to one person. Because the offender is looked up to and liked in the community, the offended will wonder what is wrong with them that they are being treated this way. It doesn't make any sense. They don't treat others this way. Then add to the undermining emotionally and the blame. Another sign of an unsafe relationship is the person feels trapped and helpless. And every time the offender blames the offended when they try to get help, leads to more hopelessness. Reconciliation only happens when the offender is broken, repentant, and takes responsibility. This is not when the offender says he or she is broken. Because if the offender has to say they're broken, then I'd question whether they are. The brokenness is something the others will see. Patrick Doyle asks the question, how can a person of faith treat a person so wrongly and God not convict them? Which is clear evidence that the denial is very strong. Until the person takes full responsibility for everything they have done, there is no repentance regardless of what the offender says. False humility, worldly sorrow, or sorrow for being caught or play the victim is not repentance nor conviction. Oftentimes, churches try so hard to quickly make things normal or good so it all looks good. The offender has confessed. This, however, emboldens the offender for repeat offending. The offender must be convicted by God, repentant, not litigating consequences, nor because the spouse or someone else is upset. It is totally separate. It is completely spiritual. So broken for what they did before God and how they just destroyed another person. They are profoundly behaviorally motivated to change, and there's a sorrow for their actions. If behavior is not convicted and soft, changed by God, the offender cannot be trusted and the victim must be protected. And I think that's an important aspect when we look at unsafe relationships. Moving on to sexual abuse. 1 Corinthians 6:9-10. Do you not realize that those who do wrong will not inherit the kingdom of God? This is out of the New Living Translation. Don't fool yourselves. Those who indulge in sexual sin or who worship idols or commit adultery or are male prostitutes or practice homosexuality or are thieves or greedy people or drunkards or abusive or cheat people, none of these will inherit the kingdom of God. So what is sexual abuse? And that's a question I get asked a lot. If the person was not raped, then is it not abuse? Is that true? If someone is raped, it is because of what they did. It's their fault. Maybe they didn't dress right. Or they had suggestive behavior. What is sexual abuse? Sexual abuse includes any sexual or sexually motivated behavior that is done to someone without the person's consent. This includes a continual sequence of intrusive behaviors ranging from hands-off offending, which we'll be looking at as well, such as voyeurism and verbal comments, up to and including sexual penetration with or without violence. Sexual abuse in criminal law, any act of sexual contact that a person suffers, submits to, participates in, or performs as a result of force or violence, threats, fear, or deception, or without having legally consented to the act. So that's the criminal version. So looking at examples of sexual abuse, fondling, touching, playing, massaging intimate private parts of another with or without clothes, without the other's consent. Now, some of these are sin, we are well aware of it, but we're looking at it from the standpoint of abuse. Or if they were forced to do that to someone else, would also fit into that category. So if it was done to oneself, or if an individual was forced to do that to someone else. Exposure, someone exposing themselves to another person, or an individual is forced to expose themselves to someone else. Rape, demanding sex by force or using threats. I'm just going to make a statement along with that. If someone was, and this includes in a marriage relationship, if someone is pressured into a sexual relationship with anger, the person will always feel raped. And that is in marriage. Involuntary prostitution, sex slave, sex trafficking, offering someone for sex to another person. Involuntary homosexuality, bribed or forced into homosexual activity. Involuntary bestiality, bribed or forced into sexual activity with animals. Involuntary abortion, tricking or bribing or forcing someone into having an abortion. Then there's the non-touching sexual abuse, being shown videos or sexual pictures, involuntarily made to listen to sexual talk or comments about one's body, involuntarily made to pose for seductive or sexual photographs, involuntarily made to look at sexual parts of the body, involuntarily made to watch sexual acts, being watched in a sexual way while clothed or unclothed, and that would include voyeurism. And if, for those of you that don't know what voyeurism is, then that is spying on people without them knowing, and whether that's a hidden camera in a bathroom or bedrooms or whatever. Or receiving intrusive written or spoken questions or comments in person or online. Just recently, I was asked a question if I know a particular individual, and I said I didn't. And this person then sent me a number of text messages that they had received, and I was horrified. And it's coming from inside the Mennonite church. I actually wouldn't even read the text messages here. The next thing we're going to look at, I don't know if you've been heard of this at all or not, it's what they call MAP. MAP stands for a minor attracted person. It's a relatively new term that is making its rounds, because pedophile is too nasty of a word. It sounds too harsh. That's like saying, if somebody killed someone, they're not really a murderer, are they? They're just a life taker. Or if somebody walked in here with an illegal handgun, it's not really an illegal handgun, is it? It's just a cordless hole puncher. We don't do that with those things, do we? I found this actually fairly disturbing. I'm not talking about trashing someone or putting someone down, but we have to call it what it is. And that's the only way some of these individuals will get help. We have some local groups and organizations that are looking at this whole child sexual abuse issue and wanting to call it something more tolerable, less offensive. This term MAP, and I found this interesting, but apparently this term MAP is now included in literature with doctors and psychiatrists and anti-sexual abuse organizations. Dr. Alan Walker stated in 2021, he believes a pedophile sexually attracted to children is hardwired, born that way, and is not a matter of choice. Therefore, he prefers to call it MAP because it carries less stigma. And he wrote a book called The Long Dark Shadow, Minor Attracted People and Their Pursuit of Dignity. This group is also looking at connecting with the LGBTQ, and I'm not sure what all the other letters are. They're looking at joining up with them. I don't know if they'll be accepted or not. And we ask the question, how has it got to this? How have people come to a place where we actually call this okay? Where do we stand? Where do you and I stand on the whole thing of abuse, of sexual abuse, sexual violation of children? Are we guilty? And this is a question I want you to ponder. Are we guilty of minimizing what is actually going on under our noses? My dad used to make a comment, and he said it a number of times. He said, the way the home is the way the church is, and the way the church is the way the land will be. And when we look at what's going on in our land, I'm looking at it from a reverse perspective. When we look at what's going on in our land, what's going on in our churches? What's going on in our homes? It's actually a fairly sobering thought, isn't it? Here's a few statements and questions that sexual abuse victims have told me, or that they were met with when they dared to start opening up a little bit. What did you do that this happened to you? This is a good person. He would never do that. Look at all the good they are doing and have done. Are you lying? And if you're lying, you know that there's punishment for lying. Are you sure this happened? Or are you just making it up? I will talk to so-and-so, and if it's not true, you will be punished. And very often what will happen in those cases, if it's a child, the parent will go ask the perpetrator if they did something like that. Guess what the perpetrator is going to say? No, I didn't do it. Another statement. Why are people trying to badmouth such good people? Oh, some people have an issue with that person and are trying to destroy him or her, and on it goes. And a very common phrase that I hear over and over. I have this from a very reliable source. And I'm at the point when I hear that term, then I know immediately that whatever's going to get said next is not going to be true. I have been told that over and over and over. I have heard this from a very reliable source. And then they go on to tell me one particular case. It was about a person having surgery. And I know the person very well. This person actually told me. And they didn't have surgery. Oh, yes, you did. I know you did. I have it from a very reliable source. So you might as well just admit it that you had surgery. Does the individual not know if they had surgery or not? I would hope so. But they had it from a reliable source. The other person knew that they had surgery when the person themselves didn't. That's just one example. Another one is, I just don't believe it. It's not true. Or, just tell me this isn't true. And many more such statements. I am going to say this. If a young child has strange sexual behavior or starts talking sexually, you can almost count on it, they've been abused. A child does not think sexually unless something happened. The statements that I just went through, this will silence almost all victims of any sexual abuse. Actually, it'll silence a victim of any abuse, really. I've been into this type of work now approximately 18 years. And I'm beginning to wonder if we don't have as big of a problem in the church as there is outside the church. Actually, I'm not wondering anymore. I should rephrase that. It's just far more hidden and undercover. According to Jimmy Hinton and according to the RCMP officer, it would sound like it's a problem. Just a few common misconceptions of and facts about sexual abuse. Child sexual assault is a rare occurrence. Recent studies, now that says recent studies, I'm not sure how recent that is. I've had that page for quite a while. Suggests that 1 in 3 girls and 1 in 5 boys will experience some form of sexual assault before the age of 18. The victim is a teenage girl. Victims are often between the age of 4 and 11. However, boys and girls of any age are vulnerable. 22% of all abused children are under the age of 6. I would actually put that percent higher, I think, but maybe that's just because of what I see. The offender is a stranger to the child, is the misconception. The fact is, in 85% of the cases, the offender is known to the child, such as a parent, relative, old neighbor, friend, etc. 40% of all cases, the offender is a father figure. Another misconception, the assault is a violent attack and leaves the child with physical injuries. The fact is, the assault is usually nonviolent. The child is engaged by persuasion, threats, bribery, trickery, rather than by physical force. Another misconception, child sexual assault is a single isolated incident. 88% of reported cases, the child is repeatedly subjected to the sexual assault because the child is usually persuaded to keep the activity a secret, and it can go on undetected for years. And there's a number of more in there, and you have those in your list there. I think that's in the book. So I'm just going to move on for the sake of time. Next one is spiritual abuse. Matthew 18:6, if anyone causes one of these little ones, those who believe in me, to stumble, it would be better for them to have a large millstone hung around their neck and be drowned in the depths of the sea. I mentioned how some of other abuses are minimized, overlooked, and excused. I'm going to say this one is most often outright denied. Let's take a look at what a spiritual abuse is. It's communicating who God is, who Jesus is, or his truth, or using God's word in an unloving, condemning, and damaging way. Such as using God in the scriptures to control people through guilt, using God in the scriptures to attack, belittle, or put people down or shame them, use God in scriptures as a standard of performance, use God in the scriptures to set a standard the Bible never communicates, and using God in the scriptures to shun or withdraw from a person. The devastating result is it locks a person's heart against God. Against Jesus, against prayer or the Bible, and we'll look some more at that this afternoon, thus destroying an intimate relationship with God. And what often happens with spiritual abuse is a person's heart is totally locked against God, and they can't pray. They might even have mechanical prayers. One individual would be I have to pray. I was like, you do? Yes, I have to. Why is that? Well, if I don't, then God's going to make more bad things happen to me. I have to pray. I have to pray so many times a day. And I'm like, really? I said, I'm going to ask you to do a really, really strange thing. And please hear me out until I'm done. I'm going to ask you to stop praying. I don't want you to pray anymore. No more praying. You're all done. Oh, no, I can't do that. I said, yeah. I'm just asking you to stop praying. We're all done with that. We don't need that anymore. Well, the only way I will is if you can promise me that God's not going to make more bad things happen to me if I stop praying. Yeah, I can promise you that. You're sure? Yes, I'm sure. So you're okay with stopping? No more praying? Only because you're asking me to. I said, okay. Sounds good. What I'd like to do now is I'd like to talk to Jesus just a little bit. And let this person in a short little prayer. Jesus, do you love me? Do you care about me? Do you care about the little boy or little girl inside that's so afraid? And I don't know where I went that day. But after I stopped, the response was, well, I've never done that before. I said, that's praying. I said, I don't want you to keep doing what you're doing. That's why I asked you to stop praying. But if praying becomes forced, don't use the word pray anymore. Just talk to the Lord. It's about a relationship with God. And in that particular case, and this is probably one of the saddest things, in that particular case, it's no different than the heathens in the jungles of Africa that are doing all kinds of horrible things to appease the gods. And we're treating our Heavenly Father that way. We're trying to appease Him. And all He longs for is a relationship with you and me. I'm not going to take the time to look at the scriptures that are listed there. There's a number of scriptures listed in there. I encourage you to look those up. In Ezekiel chapter 33 and 34, there's some pretty straightforward statements about what happens with spiritual abuse. And it leaves the term. In fact, in Ezekiel 34, verse 5, it says, and they were scattered because there was no shepherd. They became meat to all the beasts of the field, and when they were scattered, my sheep wandered all through the mountains upon every high hill. Yea, my flock was scattered upon all the face of the earth, and none did seek after them. They became prey for the wild beasts. And it talks about that in those chapters, and I encourage you to look that up. Now, who are these shepherds? These shepherds can be parents. These shepherds can be school teachers. These shepherds can be church leaders. These shepherds can be counselors. These shepherds can be any of us as adults. And some of the most tragic things is when this happens to the little ones, they become prey for the enemy of our souls. And the enemy will take advantage of that. Because there are people that have totally turned against God. An example of that is a phone call I got one day. They had booked a 10-minute phone call. The first 5 minutes was to make sure that they're talking to me. And then there was silence for about a minute, maybe longer, I don't know. I hate God. I hate Jesus. I hate the Bible. I hate the church. I hate Mennonites, and I don't want anything to do with any of them. Then it was quiet. And I said, really? Are you mad? No, I'm not mad. Are your face muscles tight? No. Are your knuckles white? No. I'm quite relaxed. You sound relaxed, but did you not hear what I just told you? I said, yes, but somebody has drastically hurt you. That phone call lasted 2.5 hours. With many more phone calls after that. That person still struggles to go to church, but they go to church. They do read their Bible. And they have a relationship with the Lord that day I didn't know would happen. The day she called, I had no idea if it would happen or not. I've got a lot more here I could cover. I'm going to move on. Some of this we'll be looking at this afternoon as well. I'd like to go move on into the section called secondary victimization. If you have some questions on what's in your notes that in the areas I skipped, feel free to ask. Secondary victimization refers to behaviors and attitudes of social service providers or authority figures to the victim that are victim blaming and insensitive, which traumatizes victims of violence and abuse. And that can be parents, teachers, pastors, counselors, police, and the list goes on. Examples of secondary victimization: the refusal to recognize the victim's experience as criminal victimization when it is. What did you do that this happened to you? You realized lying is bad, and we looked at a number of these. Look what this does to our family. This is awful. No one will ever want you if they find this out about you. If you would behave, then this would have never happened. If you were more spiritual, then this would not have come to this. I want you to listen to this last one. This one hurt. It must have been God's will, because God is in control of everything. It is never, never, never God's will for anybody to be abused. Evil does not come from God. Why does he allow it? He could stop the perpetrator on the spot and kill him or her. But God is not willing that any should perish. He cares for the perpetrator's soul as much as he does for the soul of the victim. And that's our goal today, is to also look at that. Not only the victims, but also the perpetrators. They need help. In Matthew chapter 18, verse 6, it says, "But whoso shall offend one of these little ones." The offend there means, in the Greek, actually means to scandalize. To offend the moral sense of or shock comes from the Greek word scandalon, which means a behavior or attitude that causes another to sin or a stumbling block. If God would do what he says is better for him, the offender, referring to the offender, I'm wondering how many millstones would be at the bottom of the sea not grinding flour. There's a lot in the, a lot more that could be said, but I'd like to move on into the next one, and that is grooming. Grooming is when we think this primarily happens in sexual abuse, and it does happen with sexual abuse, but it can happen with any of the other abuses as well. Why does grooming happen? Why do perpetrators do this? What are they looking for? Very often it's control. Some important aspects of grooming. The individual doing the grooming will first groom themselves. The individual will do anything to put on a facade to appear not to be a pedophile. They'll tell themselves they care about the child and the child needs to learn. Number two, they will groom the victim. And how does that look? And this is important to actually be aware of. Watch for it. I think we all have a responsibility to be watching out for this. Eight stages of grooming. First one is targeting the individual. The offender typically has a preference to gender, age, or type of an individual and will pay special attention to him or her. The individual is made to feel their best. Number two, gaining the individual and caregiver's trust. For example, I saw you playing with Legos. I'm planning to go do so-and-so. Would you want to join me? They look and act like the nice guy. They portray themselves as being there for the individual's need. They go out of the way to help the child's parents or help the individual. Number three, filling a need. I know you love reading, so I got you this book. They study the individual's environment and look for the vulnerable and weak spots and prey on those. And these perpetrators have unique ways of figuring that out. Isolating the individual, you can trust me because no one understands you more than I do. Special trips, one-on-one coaching, babysitting. Test the victim to see if they can keep secrets to never tell by giving them things they know they are not allowed. And just see if they can keep that a secret. Then they start sexualizing the relationship. Have you ever watched porn? I can show you what it is. What do you know about sex? I can teach you things that no one will ever tell you. Sex is designed by God and for us to enjoy. He enjoys what we're doing. Confusion. Why am I feeling so dirty and not good? It's all my fault because I enjoyed parts of it. What would my parents, church, and friends say if they knew? This person goes to church, so maybe it's okay. Number seven. Keeping them in confusion. Act as if nothing had bad happened to the parents. If questioned, laugh it off with, you're just too sensitive. Everyone else does it. They just don't talk about that. Talk about it. This is normal. If you tell anyone, they'll think you're crazy. Maintaining control. If you tell anyone, something bad could happen to you and your family. If you tell anyone, we could both go to jail and wouldn't be able to be together. Or they will kill a small animal in their presence and say that that's what I'll do to you if you ever tell. Just going to read a short section in here. Jimmy talks about grooming. He prefers to call it testing rather than grooming. He says, groom means to get into readiness for a specific objective or prepare. And he says that that is already done. For in most cases within the church. The test then is to make a preliminary test or a survey as of reaction or interest before embarking on a course of action. What Once an abuser introduces himself to a parent or of a target child, all he has to do is create the reality and values that those parents want or expect to see in others. The father of several siblings that my dad abused at another church gave me this chilling account. So this is now the father of the abused children. I hadn't been to church for years. I decided it was time to take my kids to church and reconnect with God. Your dad spotted me from across the sanctuary and beelined over to me. He was the first person to talk to me. Now notice, this is Jimmy's dad. And he noticed them from across the room. There's some significance to that. There was an immediate connection, and looking back, he was finding out all kinds of personal information about me and my kids, and I never questioned it. Is there a Mrs. Smith? Isn't it overwhelming being a single father? Tell me about your beautiful kids. Your dad got so much information from me so quickly, and everything he said made perfect sense. I really connected with your dad. That same day, your dad suggested that he become a spiritual mentor to me, and I gladly accepted. He knew that I would accept it based on the information I'd given him about wishing I had someone in life to help guide me. I was desperate to connect with God, and everyone told me what a great man your dad was. This was no more than a few-minute conversation. My dad walked into a room of 200 or so people that day, and within literal seconds spotted his targets without ever saying a word to them. From there, he approached the dad, tested him and the kids, and within days was sexually abusing those children. Jimmy gives an account of him visiting a church with his three-year-old daughter. When my oldest daughter was 3 years old, we visited a church. I was walking through the church foyer when an older man stopped me. He started talking to my daughter and tried to tickle her under her armpit. I pulled her away before his finger could touch her. I asked him to stop and said that neither of us liked that he was trying to tickle her. He ignored me and attempted again to tickle her. I pulled away and didn't allow him to make contact. He gave up on trying to tickle her and then said that my daughter was beautiful. He said her cheeks and eyes are very pretty and that she'd be a heartbreaker one day. He said this about a three-year-old toddler. At that point, I had enough. I said loud enough for people around us to hear, "Let's go away from this creepy man. He doesn't take no for an answer." Maybe he was an abuser. Maybe he wasn't. But I wasn't going to stay near him long enough to find out. That gives you a little bit of a glimpse. Next one is willful blindness. And this is purposely ignoring or turning a blind eye, pretending to know or to see, or a deliberate act of remaining unaware. Let's look how it works. If a man walked in here today, right now, while I'm speaking, sat down beside one of the ladies sitting here, and started snuggling up to her, would you feel anything inside? I see a few heads shaking, yes. You can see that this lady is obviously uncomfortable. Fear grips her. If she runs out, she has no protection if he follows. She is sure no one else will come out to help her. Whether that's true or false, it's real to her, so she freezes. Who in here would stand up and go rescue that lady? Stand in between, help her escape. We wouldn't want to make a big show now, would we? Hopefully someone else will do it. Well, maybe it's somebody she knows. I would hate to embarrass myself or anyone else. That's willful blindness, right there. I asked, did you feel anything in your gut? Some of you did. We've all been guilty of ignoring those gut instincts. I know I have. There's a situation that happened at a gas bar one day in a local town. And it still haunts me to this day. I have no idea what the situation was, but it did not look good. There was a girl sitting in the passenger seat of that vehicle that day. The look on her face still haunts me. I felt something inside and I did nothing. I'll never forget that. I didn't see anything that I thought was out of place. It was the look on her face. She made no contact with anybody outside of the vehicle. She looked on the floor. And the guy was out putting gas in his vehicle, and he was a charmer, knowing some of the stuff I do now. Preparing for this, that memory came back again, and it still haunts me. The least I could have done was called 911 and get it checked out. Now, back to the story if this guy came in here. If I would confront this guy, I'd stop talking and I'd go to wherever this guy is sitting and I'd confront him. And he might respond with, well, how stupid do you think I am? I'm not here to hurt her. Why, am I not welcome to hear the truth? Why are you judging me? Do you know what will start happening inside of me? Well, maybe I am overreacting. Now I made this guy feel bad when he wanted to come hear the truth. Do you know what the truth is? He didn't want to hear the truth. So in order to keep peace, I back off and I'm not willing to stand up anymore. He sits back down with her and carries on. And I let it go on. And I come up here and speak about abuse right while it's happening under my nose. Is that actually what we would do? I hope not. But that's willful blindness. As we wrap up this topic, and I know I've gone over time, is our responsibility before God. Matthew 7:33, and then will I profess unto them, I never knew you, depart from me, ye that work iniquity. And iniquity there means, in the Greek, illegality, violation to the law, transgress the law of righteousness. Then if we go to Matthew 25, verses 41 to 46. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'd encourage you to look it up. But in verse 43, I was a stranger and you took me not in, naked. And I'd like to look at that word a little bit. The word naked in the Greek means just that. Absolutely no clothes on. And then it says, and you clothed me not. Clothed in the Greek means to throw all around, that is to invest with a palisade or with clothing. And a palisade in the noun form is a fence of wooden stakes or iron railings fixed in the ground, forming an enclosure or defense. And the verb means to enclose or provide a building or a place. So it's not just talking about it has a much deeper meaning than just being clothed. The word naked there means absolutely no protection whatsoever. And verse 43 says, I was naked and ye clothed me not. In other words, you could say, I had absolutely no protection, and nobody did anything about it. In closing, I'd like to say, for all those that have been triggered this morning, for that I'm sorry. There's some very hard things said. Some of you might be surprised that these things exist among our people and that I was too harsh. Some of you may say I didn't say near enough because you have experienced what I was talking about. But like I said, when I started, I find myself in a very difficult spot. I will say, my heart is broken. And I really, really struggled with knowing what or what not to say. But I've tried my utmost to share what God wanted me to share and be sensitive to God. And I'd like to close with the verse in Psalm 19, verse 14. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, my strength and my redeemer.